The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Welcome to Crime and Justice Radio, where we talk all things crime, justice, mayhem, and the courts with expert insiders and legal outcasts. My name is Aida Leisenring, and I'm your co-host, and I'm here with Bruce Barquette, my co-host every Monday night. Happy Martin Luther King Day, Bruce.
Almost every Monday night. Every once in a while, I'm not here.
Really?
Occasionally.
Doesn't feel like it.
I know. Feels like I'm with you every second of every day. How are you tonight?
I'm doing very well.
We've got a jam-packed show with a fascinating guest. Julian Assange's lawyer, Barry Pollack, is going to join us in the second half to chat about Julian Assange. For those of you who recognize the name but say, what's that about? He is the founder of WikiLeaks, who disclosed a slew of material he got from Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning and others concerning the Iraq War, the Clintons, a whole series of things. He's now under indictment in an in English jail fighting extradition to the United States. We'll talk more about him, but I wanted to let people know that his lawyer, his American lawyer, is going to be on our show in a little
Barry
while.
Barry Pollack.
Barry.
Who you're familiar with.
I know.
And so is Marty Tankliff.
Oh, well, we'll leave that.
How does Marty Tankliff come up every episode?
I don't know.
Well, but he participated with you. You guys were the
yes,
dream
yes.
team.
Yes.
The capital B's,
yes.
if you will, Bruce and Barry, and another Barry.
But Barry Pollack has gone on to great things, including Julian Assange, which I'm looking forward to chatting about. And to be honest, I've known Barry for, I think, 20 years now or thereabouts, and I've never really chatted with him about Mr. Assange. So it'll be a fascinating conversation. And happy Martin Luther King Day to you as well, Aida.
Thank you. I was actually doing some minor research on Martin Luther King to see if there was speeches I hadn't really heard of or hadn't been reminded of. And as I was doing my research, I learned something I actually didn't know. I'm sure I might have learned it back in school, but I just didn't realize that he actually, besides being assassinated, he had an attempted murder, if you will, back in, I think it was, let me look at my notes here, 1958. A woman, Izola Curry, an African-American woman, attempted to assassinate him and stabbed him with a letter opener at a Harlem book signing on September 20th of 1958 during the Harlem Civil Rights Movements. And it actually inspired, in part, one of his memorable, though not often quoted, "I've been to the mountaintop" speeches. And I started reading that, and by the way, he almost died, and the doctor indicated that the tip of the blade was on the edge of his aorta, and once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. So if he was to sneeze, he could have died. And during that speech, he recalls receiving this letter. "Dear Dr. King," it read, "I'm a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School. While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering, and I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy you didn't sneeze." So, but that got me to the speech, and I want to take out a segment, because whenever you read brilliant genius works from people, no matter what age, they are ageless. And during that, and the "I've been to the mountaintop," he was leading the protest against the unsafe work conditions of sanitation workers. He said, basically, if God gave me the opportunity to have a bird's eye view of all of humanity in the world, what would I choose? And he goes through all the different stages, Egypt, the Roman Empire, and then he talked about then, where when he chose to live. And he said, "Now that's a strange statement to make, because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land. confusion all around. That's a strange statement, but I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars, and I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men, in some strange way, are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and whether they be assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free.
It is a remarkable, his life, which only he died at, he was murdered at 39 years old. So he did not live that long, but had a huge impact, obviously. And the part of his persona that I find impressive is his hope. He was quintessentially the happy warrior, always looking forward, always hoping for the best, always aspiring towards what was best in humanity and appealing to our better nature. Our better angels, as they say, not our fears, not our bigotry, not our hate, not our jealousy or envy, but appealing to our hope and to our love and to our humanity. And he was a devoutly religious man. You forget that he was a minister, and his speeches and writings were laced with references to Christ and the New Testament, and way ahead of his time on an issue that you and I have spoken about before, which is the death penalty. He was asked about this in an Ebony article in 1957, and he responded, "I do not think God approves of the death penalty for any crime, rape, murder included. Capital punishment is against a better judgment of modern criminology," 1957, "and above all, against the highest expression of love in the nature of God." A remarkable statement from a, at that point, a 20-some-year-old man in 1957. And if I can just reflect a bit more, you have Martin Luther King being murdered in 1968. Malcolm X was murdered in the 60s. John F. Kennedy was murdered in the 60s. Robert Kennedy was murdered in the 60s. In 1970, four students were shot and killed by the National Guard at Kent State. And shortly thereafter, George Wallace was shot and paralyzed from the waist down. And you talk about the divisions that we have in our political and legal life now. Think about living through that time period. And I know you did.
As a politician, I guess.
Well, but it was four students at Kent State. And this is just kind of some of the highlights. Obviously, there were other deaths and murders. I recall all of this. I grew up with John F. Kennedy's shooting. I was 4 years old at the time.
I grew up with George Bush choking on a pretzel.
Different. But you think about what came from that. The civil rights legislation, a host of different improvements in society, if you will. And we fear the division that exists now, but we don't have, thankfully, the murder of political leaders from both sides. So there's some hope for us.
Well, we thank him not only for the Herculean strides that he made in civil rights, but also, as you said, for the inspiration he continues to give people to love one another, to stand together as equals, and to have mercy. And I think the reason he was so successful, or why he impacts me, and we don't see this trait enough today, is because he was authentic. He believed in what he said. It wasn't for money. It wasn't for political support. It wasn't for popularity. He simply believed it. And while, you know, the world we live in now is our world to fix, and there are always going to be crises and
challenges,
and he constantly counseled everyone to serve others, right? And part of what we do is a service. We counsel our clients into how they're going to succeed, or, you know, I guess minimize damage in the criminal justice system, but what I love about that speech is, I've been to the mountaintop. He says, like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as people will get to the promised land. And so I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming Lord. And so you and I may not see equality in the criminal justice system in our lifetime, but we'll continue to serve and we'll continue to make differences. And last year, I saw what was the most remarkable wave, bipartisan wave, against the death penalty in a way that I had never seen. And all focused on Julius Jones and Oklahoma. And it began a real, true, honest national dialogue from all sides of the political aisle about the merits of having a death penalty. And thankfully and thank God, Julius Jones's sentence was commuted to life. And there are others that remain on death row in the states that still permit the death penalty, and obviously...
And there have been executions
since.
Julius Jones's sentence was commuted. There have been executions in Oklahoma since then. And as you pointed out on a social media site, the chairman of the Pardon Parole Committee was...
Adam Luck, yeah.
...was essentially fired by the governor for taking a stand against the death penalty on the Pardon and Parole Committee.
Well, when he was, I don't know what the word is, nominated. What do you call it when?
No, nominated.
He was selected by Governor Stitt to be a parole board member. There was a moratorium on the death penalty, so he just saw people that had been sentenced to a certain specified period of time or life and saw to it to vote to commute or not commute the sentence. But then, once the moratorium ended, he was faced with a very serious decision in his view. I mean, it always is, right? But I think based on his voting record on death penalty cases, Governor Stitt replaced him.
Well, he wrote to the governor in responding to the governor's request that he resign, saying that my votes have cost me the job, essentially. He acknowledged it and said, I'm comfortable with what I have done right, and the votes I have made, and I'll move on.
I am comfortable as well. Now, I want to go back to Martin Luther King and his stabbing during the book signing. So this woman, Miss Curry, who stabbed him, was mentally ill. And he bore no animus towards Miss Curry, and he didn't want charges to be pressed. Talk about mercy. So that leads me to all the mental illness crimes that are being highlighted and underscored in the media. Simon Marshall shoved Michelle Goh in the subway tracks, and I don't think anyone contests that he's mentally ill. His family supports that he's been in and out of mental health institutions his whole life, and he's been on medication. He's had prior robberies, and he was recently discharged from upstate in August of 2021. So he has a I think documented history of persistent mental illness. But whether or not that means that he'll actually be able to plead, well, he'll be able to plead in sanity,
prevail on it
is an entirely different.
Well, yes, it is. And look, you've mentioned this to me before in preparing for shows that we should have a mental health expert, a forensic psychiatrist or psychologist on. And I think that's a great idea. We should try to do that, to have some expert to come in and chat about what it means to have a mental illness to the extent that it causes you to commit crimes or allows you to commit crimes, especially the crime of murder. I have to say that my first take on this wasn't focused on this individual's mental illness one way or the other. He may prevail, he may not. We'll have to wait and see. I'm not judging it. What I was focused on, first thing that came to my mind, is Alvin Bragg's declaration that he won't be seeking any sentence more than 20 years. So assume for the time being that this person does not have an insanity defense, that they've convicted of second degree because there's no other crime associated with it. There's no robbery or rape or anything, burglary or anything like that. It's simply second degree murder. And I say simply, it's second degree murder. And the DA in Manhattan has prejudged that he individuals should not serve more than 20 years. To me, that's as offensive as the legislature issuing mandatory minimums, saying no matter what happens, X should be your minimum sentence. It's not for Mr. Bragg to predetermine what sentences should be. The legislature has laid out the minimum and maximum penalties.
Well, but he can. And Policy is policy. You and I always do this. We understand your policy is this, but we think this is an exceptional case that should be considered outside of the policy, right? And frankly, if you represented Simon Marshall with this documented history of mental illness and the prosecutor said to you, I'll give him an offer of 20 years, would you take it?
Of course not. Of course I would.
No, you wouldn't.
20 years?
You would take 20 years on your client comes to you, he's completely mentally ill.
Well, if you had a valid insanity defense, but we don't have to think too hard to think of cases that we would have jumped on 20 years in their similar circumstances.
Right.
And I say we. I mean our firm and me.
He was talking about God and babbling and had a history of being found on subways babbling like the crazy person that he is, and I don't mean that in a demeaning way, but he literally was mentally ill. And by the way, this isn't an isolated incident. As you know, a 70-year-old nurse was waiting at a bus stop in LA and she was beaten to death by a homeless man at a bus stop. A UCLA student was stabbed to death in a random attack that had nothing to do with.
They're going
to
be crimes and murders, right? And by mentally ill people.
Are we seeing a rise in mental illness, a lack of resources for these individuals, more depression, less access to medication and care and housing? And is that affecting our streets more than it otherwise would? And Michelle Goh, I just want to say briefly about her, because she obviously matters, had a master's from NYU, worked at Deloitte, and actually volunteered helping the homeless. So she, like Dr. Martin Luther King, may have been merciful in deciding what the appropriate sentence would be, but that's a very, very hard evidentiary standard to overcome, the insanity plea, because you have to pretty much prove that the individual lacked the capacity to know the nature and consequence of what he was doing and that the conduct was wrong. And there's two facts that I know the prosecutors will jump on to overcome an insanity defense. One is a witness that was cited in the New York Times saying that she saw this individual and it appeared that he waited just until the moment the train was coming to ensure that she was killed. And secondly, it appears he voluntarily surrendered 15 minutes later.
All right. No, so he may not succeed. And look, the mental illness part of this is certainly there. We had a sergeant on last week, I think, who spoke about the pandemic causing or contributing to the rise in crime because of the isolation, the lack of health care, the lack of psychiatric care.
Sergeant Fredericks, and we had someone from Rikers, Katie Needy. She also says the same thing.
Same thing. So I don't doubt that that's happening now. I do think, and I hate to be on this side of this issue because I'm a criminal defense attorney by trade, and you know me well enough to know it's part of my being. This Alvin Bragg and this attitude towards the prosecution of crime is a real problem. I was around in the late 80s. I was a prosecutor then. In the early 90s, I was in New York City. What he is doing, he's going to wreck the city. It's not the way to enforce the law. You can't do what he did. It's been tried. It didn't work. And I think it's absurd.
When was it tried?
That was the attitude back then. That was how, that was a big difference between
but different problems back then.
It was the idea that you can cap murders, no matter what, at 20 years is, in my view, ridiculous. And the silliness of it, if you will, is revealed by this very murder, where you're looking at this and you want to say to the prosecution, really? 20 years? That's enough?
Right.
And it's very troubling to me because I don't see this going in a good place. And I still will fight for our clients and for their rights and for
I'm not advocating for 20 years, more than 20 years, less than 20 years, or an insanity defense on this individual. I don't know the facts of the case. I know that this woman needlessly died and that this could have been prevented. And that to me is a giant, colossal societal failure. But hold on a second. I'm willing to be open-minded about Bragg. Let's see, because I don't think he's going to stick to the policy.
I'm going
to
say
policy is guidance, but there will be exceptions.
I'm going to say something we both agree with. And they're arresting people at Burger King for not having a vaccine pass and dragging people out for mask mandates and the rest of it. Their priorities are messed up. Forgive me.
Fair enough. Welcome back to Crime and Justice Radio. I'm your co-host, Aida Leisenring, and I'm here with Bruce Barquette.
Hello again.
Hello.
Okay. love the first half of the show. You and I don't always disagree, but we did there a little bit, and that's always fun. But I am very much been looking forward to chatting with Barry Pollack, who is Julian Assange's lawyer, and has been so for several years. Barry's an attorney that we've known for 20 years or so. So I can't believe that I actually know Mr. Assange's lawyer, because this case is just absolutely fascinating. But first, a little something about Barry. He represents individuals and corporations in criminal investigations and trials and other government enforcement matters, such as securities, exchange commission proceedings, and so forth. He is one of the, and I say this to a couple of our guests because we've been lucky to have them, one of the best criminal trial attorneys in the country. He's the past president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. That is the premier criminal defense organization in the country and has been for decades. He is the past president of the Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project. He is a CPA. In addition to the financial crimes, he has worked to free individuals on a number of different fronts and been successful in New York, New York City, and out here on Long Island, as a matter of fact. But tonight, we want to chat with him about his world-famous client, Julian Assange. Barry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bruce. Great to be here, and thanks for that overly generous introduction.
You deserve it. There was more. We actually want to ask you questions about Julian Assange. So
we only have a few minutes.
We had to cut your resume short.
A little bit. So I'm always fascinated about this. How did he end up with Barry Pollack as his lawyer?
So he was represented, both Julian individually and WikiLeaks were represented by the Center for Constitutional Rights, a great non-government organization based in New York. And when it became apparent that the U.S. government was actually seeking to bring criminal charges against him, they wanted to bring in an experienced criminal defense lawyer. And fortunately for me, I was a person they called, and so that's how I ended up representing Julian, not realizing that nearly 10 years later, I would still be representing him, and he would not yet have
the client that
these charges
never ends. And just to put it in context, in 2010, WikiLeaks published a series of leaks provided by Chelsea Manning at the time. And then the U.S. launched a criminal investigation into WikiLeaks. And around that time, Sweden had issued an international arrest warrant over allegations of sexual misconduct, which Assange allegedly claimed was a pretext to his extradition from Sweden to the U.S. So he takes refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London around this time. At what point after that do you become his lawyer?
So I started representing him shortly after he entered the Ecuadorian embassy. And he entered the embassy to seek asylum, not from the Swedish allegations, which he never believed had any merit and was proven right. They were ultimately, there were no charges were ever brought and the investigation was concluded. But to seek protection against the United States, fearing the very criminal charges that were later brought against him. And Ecuador agreed that he had right to fear those charges and granted him asylum. But what happened was the UK refused to allow him to leave the embassy to go to Ecuador and said that they would arrest him if he stepped outside the door of the embassy, even if it was to get into a car with diplomatic plates and to go to the airport and get on a plane with diplomatic plates, which was an unprecedented position to take. But that left him in limbo in the embassy for many years.
So I'm going to talk a little bit, if you can, about what it was that WikiLeaks or Assange actually released to the public. And it looks like there's a series of, I don't know if I can put them in categories, but information about the Iraq war, including what I guess has been known as the collateral murder video, other information about the Iraq war, and then Cablegate, cables between American diplomats, and then the Clinton emails.
That was later.
But all of that came from WikiLeaks. Can you talk a little bit about what each of those things are?
Sure. So there are really four categories of information that were leaked by Chelsea Manning that are the subject of the original criminal charges against Assange and still the focus of the current indictment against him. They are documents related to the war in Iraq, as you mentioned, which exposed war crimes committed by the United States government, exposed that there were thousands of civilian deaths that the United States government knew about and had not revealed, and other information that I think everybody would agree was newsworthy and, in fact, mainstream media repeatedly published from this trove of documents. There was similarly a bunch of cables that were effectively a history of the war in Afghanistan with similar releases. The third category are what you referred to as Cablegate. They were State Department cables. And then the fourth category were Guantanamo Bay detainee assessments, where the United States government assessed the supposed dangerousness or the background of various detainees at Guantanamo Bay, often revealing that the government knew that the evidence that was the so-called evidence they had against the detainees was thin or non-existent. So those were the four categories of documents that were leaked by Manning that were ultimately published and are the subject of the criminal charges.
So let me ask this, and I'm a second grader here about the legalities of this case. I look at him as a journalist, obviously. He produced WikiLeaks. It's a publishing company of sorts. I understand why someone who works in government leaking the information would get in trouble. But what about the journalist who ordinarily isn't required to reveal his source? Why go after him?
Well, and that's what makes this case literally unprecedented. There have been only a handful of prosecutions under the Espionage Act, which is what 17 of the 18 charges here are. In the history of the Espionage Act, which is a World War One era law, and in every other instance, it has been a prosecution of a government employee or a government contractor for leaking government information. There has never been a prosecution of someone for publishing that information. And that's what makes this case unique, and I think what makes this case very dangerous, because literally the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many others under the theory of this prosecution violate the Espionage Act every day of the week.
Well, wasn't
the government could pursue any one of them under this same theory.
Wasn't the issue, this general issue, addressed in Watergate or at least the Pentagon Papers?
Well, the Pentagon Papers wasn't a criminal case. The Pentagon Papers was whether or not
they could publish.
The government could stop New York Times and the Washington Post from publishing it and do so in advance. And there is some commentary in the opinion that suggests that that doesn't mean that they would be protected from a subsequent criminal prosecution. It just meant that the court didn't have the power to prevent them from publishing.
And I want to ask a little bit about some of the details of what he published, because it could kind of get lost in the in all the noise about all the different parts of this. But, the, for example, the collateral murder video, what was that?
That was a video that showed a aerial attack by United States forces against civilians on the ground, unarmed civilians, that included two Reuters staffers. And they were gunned down from this gunship. And there's audio to it where the pilots are asking permission to fire, get permission to fire, are gleeful about having shot these people. And then, of course, it later came out that these were all unarmed civilians, and the government covered that up and refused to release this video. What was released by WikiLeaks was the video itself, and also a copy of the rules of engagement that were in effect in Iraq to show that this attack violated the government's own rules of engagement.
So why isn't he a hero in some sense for publishing this material or getting this? If somebody from the New York Times did this, it would be a huge deal. He'd be all over the media doing a kind of a tour of every talk show there is.
I believe if the New York Times had published the same thing, they would have won a Pulitzer.
So
it was the Trump administration that ultimately filed an indictment against him, right?
It was widely reported in 2013 under the Obama administration that a decision had been made not to charge him. And the very reason that they decided not to charge him is because of what they deemed the New York Times problem. If you could charge Assange for this, you could charge the New York Times. There's just no principled way to distinguish the two. And the Obama administration chose not to indict him. The Trump administration, based apparently on no new evidence whatsoever, just took a different view of it and believed that this was conduct that could be charged and should be charged, and they did so.
And what's he facing, time-wise?
175 years in prison.
Got it. Now,
go ahead.
I'm gonna change speeds here. I want to hear about what Julian Assange is like. What was it like meeting him for the first time, and where was it?
Well, the first time I met him was in the Ecuadorian embassy. Julian is an incredibly engaging and interesting person. He's one of these people that knows something about everything. I mean, he's just very well read and intellectually curious. And so I honestly believe you could pick any topic out of the hat, jazz, music, literature, Spanish literature. You could pick any topic out of the hat, and he could have an intelligent conversation with you about it. So I think that just makes him a fascinating person to interact with.
What was the inside of the embassy like? Like, what were the living conditions like?
Well, the embassy is very small. I mean, Ecuador is obviously...
Ecuador is small.
It is in a townhouse in Knightsbridge. It's a stone's throw from Harrods, the department store. It does not even occupy the entirety of the townhouse. It's essentially one floor of a brownstone. And so it's, a handful of offices, a main conference room, and one room that Julian converted into his bedroom. So it's fairly cramped quarters, particularly for staying the period of time that he stayed, and, you know, with no access to the outside. I mean, there was no way for him to go outside and exercise. He couldn't leave the grounds. There's no way for him to be out and get sunshine and fresh air. There's no way for him to get medical care beyond what can be done on a house visit. So, you know, very difficult conditions to live under for a period of years, but obviously better conditions than a maximum security prison, where Julian feared he would end up if he left the embassy, and obviously he has been proven right.
Why? Look, the only how does this end for him is a question that comes to my mind, and it seems like the only way it ends for him is of some type of an exoneration in the United States. Otherwise, our very powerful government, with its very, very long arms, are going to pursue him until the day he dies.
Well, but just to rewind, he's currently serving time for violating the Bail Act.
It was only...
No.
No, it was
he's
50,
not.
50 weeks.
Oh, so, okay, it was 50 weeks. And then recently,
so
I don't know which court, but they said that he could actually be extradited. Is that not being appealed?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so he's presently being held without bail, simply pending the resolution of the extradition proceedings. So he's not serving any sort of a sentence. He's simply being held without bond. There was a evidentiary hearing before the equivalent of a trial-level court, what's called the magistrate's court there. The magistrate ultimately found that the U.S. government was not entitled to extradite him and denied the U.S. government's request for extradition.
And why
the U.S. government appealed.
Okay. Sorry, I was going to ask, why was that? Was that based on...
That was based on a combination of Julian's mental health history and the conditions under which he would be confined in the United States, both pretrial and if he were convicted, the high likelihood that he would be held at a maximum security facility, the high likelihood that he would be held in administrative segregation, the functional equivalent of solitary confinement, the availability of mental health treatment and counseling, that those conditions would be, quote, oppressive is the key legal term over there for somebody who has had some mental health history. There were numerous other grounds that were raised, whether this is a political prosecution, whether there's been an abuse of the judicial process, and the district court judge ruled against Julian on those grounds, but ruled for him that his conditions of confinement in the United States would be oppressive. And of course, you only need to win on one ground for the extradition to be denied.
And for us here in New York, one of the places that they thought he might end up with is at MCC. Is that right?
If he were in New York, he would undoubtedly end up at MCC. He's been indicted in Alexandria, Virginia. He would likely end up at the Alexandria Detention Center pretrial. Then the court found he would likely be held at ADX, Florence Supermax, if he were ultimately convicted, the same place that Ted Kaczynski and others are held, found those conditions to be oppressive.
We should note that whether or not, I know that it got reversed on appeal.
That Europe thinks our conditions of confinement are horrific.
The magistrate in England thought that the conditions of confinement here, coupled with this man's mental kind of psychiatric history, would be, what was the phrase, oppressive?
Oppressive,
and,
yes.
And when you and I and Aida and other defense attorneys visit our clients there, and we have clients there who are enduring these conditions every day of the week.
So many are experiencing suicidal ideations and talk about it. It's
but
really alarming.
I want to get back to Julian for a second because we're going to run out of time before, and I'm afraid we're not going to be able to chat about everything I wanted to chat about with. Why fight extradition? Why not let him come back here and fight the good fight here and hopefully win?
Yeah, so couple points. I'd note that the military court found that Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning, was held under oppressive conditions and gave a discounted sentence to reflect that. So even our military court has a recognition that the Bureau of Prisons does not, in terms of what are humane conditions to hold somebody under. In terms of why fighting extradition, it's for what you said, Bruce. I mean, the cards are stacked against him if he comes here and he doesn't feel like he should ever have to face the American justice system for having published material that, as we've talked about, the New York Times would be collecting its Pulitzer for publishing. The appellate court, as Aida alluded to, reversed that decision. So he is now, again, subject to extradition. But he has appealed that ruling to the UK Supreme Court. So that is the next round. Like here, the Supreme Court doesn't have to take the case. It's a matter of discretion. And so the current fight is whether the Supreme Court is willing to hear this case.
And UK Supreme Court. We're going to run out of time in just about a minute. And I want to highlight that the interesting, one of the many interesting parts of this case is there are a dozen or more organizations like the ACLU, Reporters Without Borders, who have written a letter asking the Justice Department to abandon this prosecution. To me, it seems like the government is lining up on one side and all the journalists and reporters and so forth are lining up on another. That is not a good look for the government.
Yeah, and I think that the media has been slow to come to that recognition that this is a threat to them, not just to Julian Assange. But I think they've gotten there, and I agree with you. The government is not on the side of the First Amendment, and now I think mainstream journalists are starting to get on that side.
Good. Good.
That's not a good place for the government to be.
Good for you, Barry.
We wish you the best luck.
Keep up the good fight here. It's a fascinating case. Thanks so much for giving us some time. I wish we had more to chat about the Clinton emails, but I guess that'll have to wait.
We're rooting for you, Barry. Thank you for coming.
See you next week.
Take care. Thanks so much. Bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.